This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we have an important update on three truth-teller cases, Julian Assange, Bradley Manning, and Jeremy Hammond.
It was a busy week last week, and it's going to be busy in the weeks going forward, as Bradley Manning faces a long trial, Jeremy Hammond pleads guilty to one count, and Julian Assange is still in the Ecuador embassy.
The two-month-long federal court trial against New York City's stop-and-frisk policy has finally wound down.
A policy pushed by mayor after mayor, but most pushed by our mayor, Bloomberg. After years of litigation, hopefully we will have a major victory.
We'll also speak with Ray McGovern, the ex-CIA analyst who listened with a jaded ear to Obama's May 23rd famous speech on drone warfare.
Obama's speech meant all things to all people. In the end, though, Ray McGovern concludes Obama is a wuss. And war as we know it, or war as we're used to, will go on.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, there have been recently some extraordinary developments in three significant and interrelated cases, Jeremy Hammond, Julian Assange, and Bradley Manning. Will you bring us up to date on that, please?
Well, the first thing people ought to know is, as we have this broadcast, Monday, June 3rd, is the opening of the actual trial in the Bradley Manning case. We'll go back to talk about that, but it's going to be an estimated up to 12-week trial with hundreds of witnesses, many of them secret. We'll talk about the Bradley Manning trial. That's going on at Fort Meade. Last week, I went to the guilty plea of Jeremy Hammond. And I know, Michael Smith, you've been active as well on the Jeremy Hammond Defense Committee. And what happened in court, it was on May 28th, on Tuesday, is Jeremy Hammond went into Judge Preska's courtroom, a judge who is, in my view, she seems to have it in for Jeremy Hammond in a certain way.
And she's the chief judge of the Eastern District Court here in New York City.
So Jeremy Hammond did something that, of course, a lot of people, I think, are amazed by. And he explains the reason he did it. He pleaded guilty to one count of conspiracy to access a protected computer. It's under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. That act is, of course, the same act passed in the 1990s, interestingly enough, that Aaron Swartz was indicted under for stealing, quote, stealing, and I really mean heavy quotes around stealing, the JSTOR documents, really uploading the JSTOR, the academic journals, to his computer. The word stealing shouldn't appear as part of that. They indicted him and were hitting him with a sledgehammer for doing something that wasn't even, in my view, illegal in that case, not even under their terms. And so he ultimately, because he was facing prison,
35 years,
he committed suicide. That's the law they indicted Jeremy Hammond on. Jeremy Hammond was indicted for many, many charges. He faced 32 years to life. They apparently had a fair amount of evidence against him because they had an informant named Sabu who actually turned when he was part of the group that Jeremy Hammond was part of and became an FBI informant and actually lured him into uploading various documents onto what was an FBI computer, no less. So the FBI participated in the crime. In any case, Jeremy Hammond was facing 32 years to life. He went into court. He pleaded guilty to one count of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Jeremy accepted the plea with what's a pretty routine way judges and defendants do this. There's a sort of script that of all the elements they have to agree to plead guilty to. After the plea was accepted and not in open court, Jeremy Hammond issued a statement about why he pled guilty. It's brief. We're going to link to it. But Michael, why don't you read what I consider to be an operative paragraph of it?
Well, this is what Jeremy says. Now that I've pleaded guilty, it's a relief to be able to say that I did work with Anonymous to hack Stratford, among other websites. Those others included military and police equipment suppliers, private intelligence and information security firms, and law enforcement agencies. I did this because I believe people have a right to know what governments and corporations are doing behind closed doors. I did what I believe is right.
He can be sentenced to up to 10 years. The guilty plea was taken in open court. 100 supporters were there. Other people were there. It was a very routine in the sense of it didn't go beyond what the elements of the crime were, which is that he hacked into a protected computer, Stratfor, and then he uploaded the documents. He did not say he uploaded the documents to WikiLeaks. Interestingly, WikiLeaks doesn't appear anywhere in what he pleaded to, but he said he uploaded them to the computer that Cebu controlled.
And that's Stratfor is like a private CIA.
Right. Stratfor is a private CIA, private intelligence company. He uploaded some 5 million emails. Many of those are not out yet. We can talk about that, but ultimately they found their way to WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks has over time been publishing those emails. One of the most extraordinary emails, of course, from my point of view, was the one that said there's a sealed indictment against my client and the center's client, Julian Assange. In any case, we're in court. It's very moving because here's this wonderful, brilliant man who I know you and I, Michael, spent some time in MCC with him. I don't know what your impressions were, but...
The same. Lovely. Really like the flower of his generation. A brilliant computer person, a real rebel, and a fine, decent human being who was in the movement trying to do some good. And for this system to take down one of the great examples of that generation is just a sad commentary on the way this country runs.
I think we all hate the fact that he was essentially forced to plead to a count that could get him 10 years by a sledgehammer government. And he did it. When I sat there listening to the plea, it's just saying, well, I did exactly, went into this protected computer, I uploaded the files to this other computer, which was the FBI computer, showing how participating they were. But he also, as part of that, apparently was forced to acknowledge other hacks that he did. Those weren't part of the count, but it's going to certainly be part of his sentence. Those included hacks to an FBI virtual site, to the Arizona Department of Public Safety, which is the police department that enforces the immigration laws in Arizona, other clear political targets. And so it was very moving to hear him because what you're talking about is an incredibly committed political activist. And actually, I just heard Julian Assange today on a radio interview on Democracy Now! And Amy asked him, said, Michael Ratner described Jeremy as a whistleblower. And he said, yes, but he's actually a political activist. And whistleblowing is one of the means he uses for his political activism. And I think that's brilliant. And that's Jeremy Hammond. And so now we're faced with this situation where Jeremy is going to be sentenced on September 6th, 2013. And the lawyers working on his behalf, Sarah Kunstler, Margaret Ratner Kunstler, Liz Fink, and others, are working now to try and get as many letters, petitions, etc. to the judge so she'll show some sympathy. And there's a website that we'll link to, but it's on change.org. People can get that petition for Jeremy Hammond and sign the petition on his behalf. Right now, I don't know what's going to happen. The demand is that Jeremy Hammond get time served. Time served in this case means the 14 months he served already, plus the 3 or 4 more months he'll do till September 6th. So he'll have served 18 months. And that seems to me to be the right demand, particularly when you look at the other people in the group. Other people in the group that did these hacks were people from the UK, Ireland, etc. And they were recently sentenced. And I'm not even sure any of them wound up going to prison, but the sentences were 0 to 32 months maximum. So you're talking about, you know, 2, 2.5 year sentences. It does seem that those should be the guides for the judge if she's going, you know, on their whole business. My view, of course, is Jeremy Hammond is a hero, should be let out of jail, and they should be looking at prosecuting Stratfor, the FBI, and the rest of them for what they did and for what WikiLeaks and Jeremy and others, Bradley, have exposed. But even on their terms, they shouldn't give Jeremy Hammond more time than he served, and certainly not more time than was given to people in the UK and Ireland. So that's where Jeremy Hammond is. It's an important illustration, as we've talked to you before about Aaron Swartz, of how this government is sledgehammering the truth, sledgehammering activists, trying to save its secrets and the empire's secrets. That's Jeremy. The two other cases are Bradley Manning and Julian Assange. Bradley Manning, as we said earlier, is starting his trial on June 3rd, Monday, at Fort Meade. There was a rally on Saturday the 1st. I'm speaking at something on Sunday, June 2nd, but the actual trial is starting as we are broadcasting this to you. People should remember that Bradley Manning pleaded guilty to 20 years in prison already. We had hoped, I think, that the government would stop, but under their sledgehammer theory of injustice, they're hitting Bradley harder and now want to prove crimes that can put him in jail for the rest of his life, if not even get the death penalty, although the death penalty has supposedly been ruled out, but you never know what's going to happen. The key crime they're trying to get Bradley Manning for is aiding the enemy. And that's really important to say. Imagine three pieces to this puzzle. There's Bradley Manning or any other soldier. Then there's a publisher in the middle, that whether that's WikiLeaks or the New York Times or the Washington Post. And then there's the, quote, enemy on the other side, Al-Qaeda, whatever. Bradley Manning is accused of uploading documents to WikiLeaks, WikiLeaks publishing those documents, then those documents being read by the enemies of the United States. And so therefore the charge is that Bradley Manning indirectly aided the enemy, Al-Qaeda, and its associated forces through WikiLeaks. The question is it just WikiLeaks or could it be any other press? And at court, the lawyer for Bradley Manning, David Coombs, asked the prosecutor, well, what if it had been the New York Times that Bradley Manning gave these documents to, or the Washington Post, where he actually tried to give the documents? What if they had published them? Would Bradley Manning still be accused of aiding the enemy? And they answered yes. So it's not that WikiLeaks is so much in the gun sights of the government, although it clearly is, and are probably indicted Julian Assange. They're taking the theory that any whistleblower, anybody in the military like Bradley Manning who uploads documents to a newspaper is aiding the enemy if the enemy might read them. Well, the enemy reads the New York Times, it reads Washington Post, it reads everything. Under that theory, any soldier who is going to follow in Bradley Manning's footsteps will not only be following in a 20-year sentence or a 40-year sentence, but will be committing, according to the government, the crime of aiding the enemy, a death penalty carrying case. And if you think we're going to see any other Bradley Mannings, who are few and far between and take tremendous courage, if the government's able to prevail on this, it should be understood what the government is doing. They are sledgehammering any possible criticism from a military person. And it's really serious. So as the next weeks unfold with Bradley Manning, it's extremely, extremely serious. I want to go to one last aspect, and that's Julian Assange. And I think we mentioned this last time, but it's important to understand. Julian Assange, of course, is still in the embassy in Ecuador. In his case, the development that I want to mention is what came out about a Fox News reporter, James Rosen. Recently, it was disclosed that not just was the Holder Justice Department going after the AP and looking at their records to see who their sources might be and their phone records in particular, they particularly went after a man, a Fox News reporter named James Rosen. And what they said in getting the warrant to look into his email and his phone records in particular, they said he's been in touch with someone at the State Department, I'm not sure which Department of Government, and that we think he might be a co-conspirator or aiding and abetting the leak that was made by this U.S. government official. And so here they're saying a news reporter, just by getting information, approaching someone in the State Department or National Security Agency, which reporters do every day, thousands of them do it all the time, there's thousands of incidents, that they may be coming co-conspirators or aiders and abettors and not just the press. And what's important to understand is that is the theory that they are going after Julian Assange on. When Julian Assange first disclosed the documents, or WikiLeaks did, they said, well, he had a website that solicited documents. It put the names of documents that WikiLeaks wanted. The fact that that was compiled by human rights organizations and NGOs seems irrelevant to the government. But the point was they're trying to argue that by asking for something, you're soliciting and you're essentially a co-conspirator or an aider and abettor. And what gets me, of course, is now, quote, major media is being gored by that same ox, Fox News, Fox, and they went after Julian Assange. Incredibly, they said he should be 6 feet under, drowned to death, all this stuff, or their commentators did. And now their own reporter is being treated like Julian Assange, at least in one little aspect. So let's see if they now will come forward to defend what's happening to all press with regard to the incredible onslaught by Obama against the free press and against whistleblowers. So we're having an incredibly, this is a critical series of things happening in the next year. It has to be a real pushback. Obama mentioned this in his speech because he got a lot of flack for what happened with AP and I guess with Fox. He didn't mention anything good about whistleblowers, those he still wants to hit with the sledgehammers. He did something like, we're going to look into, he said, I'm going to propose a shield law in the news. The handle for that is what hackers and others use all the time, and now, of course, everybody does, LOL, laughing out loud, and we'll end this program on Obama's promises of a shield law. LOL. Last month, closing arguments were heard in the stop-and-frisk case known as Floyd v. New York City. This is a class-action lawsuit challenging the New York Police Department's unconstitutional stop-and-frisk policy. The case charges the NYPD with the policy and practice of unreasonable, suspicionless, and racially discriminatory stops in violation of the 4th and 14th Amendments. In 2009, New York City had a record 576,394 people stopped and frisked. 84% of those were Black and Latino residents. 10 years of raw data obtained by court order from New York City Police Department showed that stop and frisks result in a minimal yield of weapons and contraband. To update this on the case, we're joined by returning guest Darius Charney, senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who works in the racial justice government misconduct area. He is currently lead counsel in Floyd v. City of New York, the federal civil rights class action lawsuit. Darius Charney, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
I know you just concluded a two-month trial, is that right, Darius?
Yeah, a little bit more, 9 weeks.
Nine-week trial on New York stop and frisk policy. Mm-hmm. It was in the newspapers every day. I know we've been litigating at the center for years. I mean, I'm not saying before you were born.
But 14 years, I guess, right?
Of litigation.
Yeah.
So you've concluded what is an arduous task. I mean, people who are on trial lawyers don't really even begin to understand. Mm-hmm. There's no reading of the New York Times in the morning. No, there's no going home and having... seeing your family is cross-examination, preparation for everything. It's like the reason I'm not a trial lawyer, actually, is all that. But anyway.
Mm-hmm. Most of my trial lawyer friends are alcoholics.
Yeah. Well, Darius is...
Well, I'm not there yet, thank God.
Anyway, this was a civil trial. It was to try and really stop, get an injunction of some sort against the stop and frisk policy. Mm-hmm. So give us some sense of your overall view of how this nine-week trial went, an arduous, arduous task. Mm-hmm.
It was in some ways fascinating, and the reason is because this was a bench trial. In other words, there was a judge but no jury. I think because of that, the judge herself just took a very active role in the proceedings. Asking a lot of questions of witnesses, of lawyers, and I think it was an interesting way to see kind of her thinking on a lot of this stuff. So that was one really interesting thing about it. I think what themes that kind of came out during the trial, I mean, there were several, but I think one of them was just this kind of head in the sand approach to this issue on the part of the higher ups in the police department. And to the point where I think it maybe even crossed the line from head in the sand to something more, nefarious is the right word, in terms of just denying that there's really even a problem or that people are even complaining about this issue or have been complaining about it for, more than a decade now. I mean, there was a point, I think, when Chief Joseph Esposito, who just stepped down as the chief of the department, he was the highest ranking uniformed member of the police department. He testified. And I remember the day he testified, there were a lot of tenants from public housing buildings in the city who had come to court to watch that day. He was asked a question about, whether or not anyone in the community had ever he was aware of any complaints about, the stop and frisk program or racial profiling, and he said no. And I remember there was just this audible gasp from the gallery, and then the judge, who again, very, very, smart judge and just very attuned with, what's going on, not only in her courtroom, but just throughout the city on this issue, you know, said, you know, she turned to him and said, really, you know, even, you know, no public housing tenants have ever complained to you about, you know, the fact that they keep getting stopped going in and out of their buildings. And he said, no, no one's ever brought those things to our attention. And I think the police department's at least public position on this is that this is really a problem created kind of by a bunch of left-wing lawyers and the media. That's their view of it, that this is really not an issue, that people of New York City actually are happy with what the police department's doing. They're making the city safer. They're saving lives. And so, you know, they don't really think that the community has any problem with the way they do stop and frisk.
Let me ask you, I want to go back to the overall view, but can you give our listeners some of the statistics? I know they're 500,000 or more. And then what kind of findings the cops make when they search or frisk all those people?
In the last, I guess, 8 years, which is our class period, and we have a class action. So our class covers 2005 through to the present. You know, there have been over 4.5 million recorded stops by the police department, which, you know, the actual number of stops is probably higher because they don't record every stop. And, you know, of those 4.5 million, about 90% of them result in no discovery of any criminal activity. You know, 90% of the people are just released and not, you know, arrested or given a ticket. And in terms of recovery of actual weapons or contraband, I mean, contraband is recovered in less than 2% of the stops, weapons in less than 1%. And then if you actually focus on guns, which is at least police department claims is the whole focus of this program, to get illegal guns off the street, it's about 0.13% of the stops result in the recovery of a gun.
So that's really the important statistic, because the idea that someone's carrying a joint or something is ridiculous. No one will be stopped for that. Mm-hmm. And there's a standard that you stop people for. Mm-hmm. So the fact you're getting, what's the percentage in terms of guns?
0.13%.
0.1. So it's less than a tenth of a percent.
Out of 1,000 people, what is that?
Yeah, you actually find a gun one or two times out of 1,000.
So 998 young people, mostly black and Latino, are busted.
Yeah.
1,000, and then maybe one or two has a gun.
And what's the standard that the cops are supposed to use?
Reasonable, articulable suspicion, which the Supreme Court set out about 45 years ago in a case called Terry versus Ohio. Essentially, the police have to have specific, articulable facts that they observe that would give them a reason to think somebody is doing something illegal. And not only articulable facts, but that the suspicion has to be individualized. It has to be unique to the person that they're stopping, which is also another, I think, big theme that came out during the case, was that to the police department, suspicion is not individualized. It's entire neighborhoods. You know, it's place, it's kind of place-based as opposed to person-based. If you live in a what they like to call high-crime area, that to them, I think, gives them reason to then stop you.
And that's not a legal standard, right? No. It's like, I mean, they don't, we're sitting in the West Village. We're not going to see a lot of stop and frisks.
Exactly.
Where I live in the West Village.
Exactly. And it also, I think, then has a racial element, which is another big thing that came out during the case. It's, you know, supervisors are always telling their officers, stop the right people. And so then the question becomes, well, who are the right people? And, you know, they were very frank about it. And I think sincere when they said, look, you know, most crime, reported crime, that, you know, we know the race of the suspects, it's black and Latino suspects. So, you know, that's who we're going to stop. First of all, that's to us blatantly racially profiling. But beyond that, I mean, if you're talking about individualized suspicion, just because somebody happens to be the same race as a crime suspect doesn't make them suspicious. And so
I think that's a very strong point. Yeah. I mean, we have, especially in a city that's 52% black and Latino, makes them all into suspects.
Exactly.
There were some stuff that I read as the trial went along where you guys put, I don't remember whether it's cops or documents, into trial about when the cop would write down what his basis for the stop was. So talk about that a little bit.
They fill out these forms, they're called UF-250 forms, every time they do a stop. And then all that information goes into a database, which we were given access to, and we had a professor at Columbia, Jeff Fagan, analyze it for us. And, you know, the two most common reasons that officers are checking off on these forms for why they stop people are furtive movements and high crime area. And, you know, high crime area, I just mentioned, that in and of itself cannot be a basis to stop someone.
I find that amazing that they actually put that down on the form. Yeah. I mean, that's completely contrary to law as a given.
Yeah,
just because it's a high crime area, you can't go in and stop and frisk
everybody. Yeah, I think it's more than, I think I'm about 60% of the stops, that's checked off as one of the reasons. And the crazy thing is that...
That's really shocking.
Is that we then did an analysis of, you know, where these stops are happening, and we looked at the actual crime rates in the areas where these stops are happening, where they're checking off high crime area. And it turns out that if you look at a low crime part of the city or a high crime part of the city, it doesn't matter. They're checking it off the same amount of the time. So it just shows that the factor itself is meaningless to them, because even if they're in a low crime area, they're still checking off high crime area.
Are they really? So that was one reason they give. And the other reason is furtive movements.
Furtive movements, which you ask five officers, you're going to get five different answers about what that means.
Did you do that at trial? You ask people?
Yeah, I mean, one officer said it's anything that grabs my attention. You know, which I found
could be anybody's haircut, the kind of clothes they're wearing, a hat,
another guy
low
said
pants,
that,
anything. Right?
Another guy said that a furtive movement could be sitting outside of a public housing building, just sitting on a bench with other people.
Amazing.
Again, and that's the second most common factor after high crime area. So it's
and you just know there's a racial component to furtive movements.
Exactly.
You know, my kid walking down the street in X kind of clothes is not going to be stopped because he's white.
That's checked off in more than 50% of the stops, and the descriptions of what we get from officers about what is or is not a furtive movement changes. And so it's incredibly arbitrary, incredibly vague term, and it's, you know, used indiscriminately by these officers.
Did you have any of the young people who get stopped, I suppose get stopped repeatedly, you have any of them on the stand talking about what it's like to go through that?
Yeah, we had... 12 different plaintiffs testify, 11 men, one woman, and they were actually, we had several young people, we had some older people that had been stopped as well. You know, and I think that they were very similar in terms of the way they described how it felt to them. You know, it was frightening, oftentimes humiliating. You know, it made them very angry, it made them distrustful of police. And it also, I think the way they were treated during these stops by police officers, you know, incredibly disrespectful, the way they were spoken to, you know, oftentimes physical force was used on them. And then when they would question what there was happening, that would lead to then further abuse. You know, you were given a summons for disorderly conduct that was clearly a bogus charge. You know, one of our clients was arrested. He was actually stopped right over, you know, the Petco in Union Square. He was walking home from work on a February evening and was stopped. And when he asked, why is this happening, you know, he was actually placed under arrest.
Unbelievable.
Of course, the charges were thrown out. The DA didn't even prosecute it because they were like, this is so ridiculous. But
it's a big drag. Yeah. You're under arrest. He was taken to the station house, if not worse, right?
Yeah.
Give us a little more sense of what is their real defense of the city here. I mean, you know, they talk about furtive movements in neighborhoods, but even they can't defend on neighborhoods, can they? They don't even try, do they?
They try to kind of muddy the waters by trying to mischaracterize what it is we're actually complaining about. So they'll say, you know, how can you criticize us for, you know, sending more police officers to high crime neighborhoods? You know, that's what we should do. That's good policing. And we, you know, have to constantly throughout the trial say, look, we're not complaining that you put more cops in high crime areas. What we're complaining about is how your officers behave there and how they treat the people who live there. So that's one thing they said. You know, the other thing they said, which I mentioned earlier, is, you know, well, if you look at who is committing crime and you look at who we're stopping, it matches up. And, you know, we attacked them in several ways on that. And the judge herself in the closing was very interesting, I think really showed that she got it, because she said, well, isn't that really a self-fulfilling thing? In other words, if you believe that all crime is committed by Black and Latino people, and then you act on that belief and you go out and you just stop all Black and Latino people because you believe that they're the criminals, then of course you're going to see a match in terms of who you're stopping and who's committing the crime. In other words, you are going to racially profile instead of using, you know, reasonable individualized suspicion. And she said that wasn't, you know, it was an argument that we were going to make, and she said it. So, you know, it showed us that A, she's obviously incredibly smart, but B, that the city's, you know, defense is, you know, it's pretty transparent. People can see right through it.
We're speaking with Darius Charney, a lawyer in the New York City stop and frisk case. We'll be right back to you after this break.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Day by day, no one tried to stop it in any way. All the peacemakers turn war officers. Hear what I say. Police and thieves in the street. Oh yeah. Fighting the nation with their guns and ammunition. Police and thieves in the street. Oh yeah. Scaring the nation with their guns and ammunition.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Darius Charney, the lead attorney from the Center for Constitutional Rights, who just completed litigating the stop and frisk trial, Floyd v. New York, in New York City. Why is the city continuing a policy that we've been litigating at the center for 14 years, that everybody finds outrageous, that it's not under standards? Mm-hmm. It reminds me, of course, I know you're involved also in the discriminatory fire department case here, the Vulcans case. And again, what should be a slam dunk situation, the mayor should just say, that's enough of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And why on stop and frisk are they holding so tightly to the fact that, whatever, I don't have anything to say. I just can't figure it out.
This goes back even before the stop and frisk litigation. This goes back to, I mean, as you guys know, you've lived in New York for decades, to the Giuliani and Bratton and the broken windows theory of policing. I mean, it's a philosophy that NYPD feels like it pioneered in the early 90s, and they feel that they've been very successful at reducing crime in New York. And so I think they really believe that they are the leaders, not only nationally, but internationally in this kind of policing. And so they have a lot invested in protecting it and holding it up as kind of an example.
And you know, it's interesting, the broken windows theory, if our listeners don't know, is the theory that don't just start with felonies, start with the most minor crimes, from turnstile jumping to a kid throwing a ball through a window. And that's the way we'll eventually get at the felonies, mm-hmm. by just taking in masses of the broken window people. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is, of course, crime is way down in the city, certainly since when I was here in the 70s and the 80s, number of murders, et cetera. And there's a lot of academics who write that this is the reason. I mean, I don't know how much this plays into the trial.
But there are a lot of academics who write that it's not.
This was something that their two experts wrote a lot about in their expert report. And we made a motion last year before the trial started, said, you know, this evidence, it's irrelevant to what the questions in this case, it shouldn't come in. And the judge agreed with us. And, you know, she has said repeatedly during this trial that, during this case and during this trial, that, you know, what she's deciding is whether what they're doing is constitutional or not. Whether or not stop and frisk is a good way to fight crime is a policy discussion that she's not the one to decide. And so she made it very clear, you know, my job is to decide whether this is constitutional or not. And so I don't want to hear about whether or not this reduces crime.
Well, that's the right decision, obviously. Yeah. It would be like setting up a turnstile on the street and saying everybody who walks on the street has to be stop and frisk. Yeah, crime might go down,
exactly.
But you can't just have unconstitutional means.
Yeah, no, and she made that point repeatedly. She said, you know, we could have preventative detention and that would reduce crime, but that's unconstitutional and I can't allow it. So, you know, she made it very clear she didn't want to hear about that.
I don't want to leave people with the impression that stop and frisk actually does reduce crime.
We're discussing
the question of whether the city's argument, which isn't allowed, they're not allowed to make if it's an unconstitutional practice.
Yeah.
But that's not saying at all that it has any effect on.
So the jury, pardon the pun, is very much out on that question about whether stop and frisk actually does reduce crime.
Darius Charney, you were the leading attorney in the case and took an active role in many of the aspects of the trial. I'd like to hear from you what were some of the high points personally when you were litigating this case over the last 9 weeks.
Well, there was a few. I guess I don't know if it's a high point or a low point. The testimony of Chief Esposito, I think, was a very notable example of something where a city official really, I think, exposed himself as if not just deliberately indifferent, actually worse, you know, somebody who was really trying to cover up for serious problems. But, you know, I think there were a number of times where I think, you know, when our plaintiffs testified, some of their testimony was incredibly moving. You know, our first witness was a young man, Devin Almanar, who was 13 at the time he was stopped. You know, his father is a retired police officer. And, you know, hearing him tell his story on the witness stand was, I think, really powerful, you know, and I think for him also just it was very empowering for him. That was true of all of our plaintiffs. Having the chance to tell your story in such a public forum and to have a federal judge listen to you and, you know, take in what you're saying, I think was really empowering for all of our clients. And for the community members watching, I think it was great for them to see that, like, you know, these stories can actually be told in federal court and you know, the press is going to cover them. So that was, I think, a high point. I'm kind of the statistics geek of the team. So a lot of that testimony was really interesting for me, you know, particularly cross-examining their experts and getting them to kind of admit some things, you know, we always knew were true, but they had never admitted in terms of, you know, what the numbers actually show. And,
you know, good in math or something? Because I've done trials. I've done, you know, I did discrimination trials. And I just remember preparing the statistics stuff. Was like not, it was a little boring for me, but it was also I got killed because there were things like standard deviations.
It's hard, you know. And it was interesting. The judge actually called the statistics experts to come back three different times because even she was like, I don't know if I understand what's going on here. You know, you guys probably remember that the, was it 2007, the police department hired the RAND Corporation to do this study, which for the last 6 years, the police department has been holding it up to show, you know, it proves we don't racially profile. And, you know, we made a big deal at the trial about that study and how it was conducted and the problems with it. And what we actually were able to uncover, which I thought was pretty amazing, was that the data that the police department actually gave to RAND to use to do its study was erroneous. There was a huge error in that data. You know, and so we confronted this commissioner, Phil McGuire, who was the guy who kind of was overseeing the RAND study. We confronted him with this error, and to watch him kind of try to talk his way out of it was pretty amazing.
McGuire, he was the head guy, right?
He's the head of their, what they call the Office of Management and Analysis. And so he, when he was confronted with this, I mean, it was a huge error. It was really big. And the judge was very troubled by it. And he started arguing with the judge to try to say it doesn't matter. And she said, well, it does matter. And I got a kick out of that.
You had mentioned early on in the interview how the city's position is that this whole thing about stop and frisk is media and lawyers, I guess. And in fact, the courtroom was filled every single day. Yeah. And in fact, there were activists involved. So just talk about where this really push came from and the grassroots coalition that was created, because it's very special what happened here.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, this, as you guys know, this fight really goes back 14, 15 years to the, you know, the late 90s and what happened after the murder of Amadou Diallo and the outrage about that. And, you know, the first lawsuit that we did, the Daniels case, really was something that came about because of the work of grassroots organizations like the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement and the National Congress of Puerto Rican Rights. And they really were the driving force behind, I think, that case. And so, you know, this case, Floyd, similarly, you know, several of our plaintiffs were members of those organizations and who had been stopped and frisked themselves. But in addition to that, you know, kind of a parallel track to the litigation was this real, I think, organizing effort that has resulted in an amazing citywide coalition called Communities United for Police Reform that, you know, CCR is a member of, as well as many other both grassroots and legal and policy organizations around the city are members of. And you know, at the same time that the litigation has been going on, they have been doing amazing organizing work and actually an incredible push for some great legislation in the city council that would address some of these issues. And they were really the ones responsible for making sure every day there was, you know, a community presence at the trial.
Our listeners should know, the judge did not decide the case when you finished your closing argument, and the city did. You have to write a brief now. So give us some sense of how you see it unfolding. And also, what's the remedy you asked for?
So we're filing our brief on June 12th, as is the city. The judge will then issue a decision at some point. I mean, she's an incredibly hard worker, as you may know, and she told us, she's like, look, this case has been going on for 14 years. It's got to be resolved. So I'm gonna try to get you a decision as quickly as possible. So, you know, we anticipate we will know by July what she's going to decide. You know, unfortunately, I don't think that's going to be the end of it. If we're victorious, the city has made it 100% clear they're going to appeal, as they did in the FDNY case, as you know.
Fire department in New York, where Darius and a team won a huge victory, and then the city appealed.
Yeah, so I can see that, you know, that's going to happen, unfortunately, no matter what. But, you know, the remedies that we're asking for, we didn't sue for money here. We sued for what they call injunctive relief, in other words, actual changes to the policies and practices. You know, the big things that we're asking for really is independent oversight. We want the court to appoint a monitor for a period of years to first of all go in and kind of do an assessment of what systems need to be changed within the police department around stop and frisk. And then more importantly, to ensure that those changes are actually made, because I think the lesson we learned in Daniels was, because there was no monitor appointed in that case, is that, you know, there was a settlement and the city said, we're gonna do all these things, or they promised to do all these things. And it turned out that, you know, 5 years later, they hadn't done many of them. And, you know, we learned the lesson that if you leave it up to this police department and this mayoral administration to change things on their own, they're not gonna do it, because what they think what they're doing is right. And so they're going to have to be pushed, unfortunately. They're going to have to be forced to do it.
It's amazing to me because you have in the fire department case, which is the discrimination case against the fire department, you have monitors there.
Yeah.
Now you're going to, if you win, you're going to have monitors in the police department. So what you're saying really is this government cannot be trusted.
I think that's right. The other question, of course, is we're, fortunately, we're going to get a new mayor at the end of the year. And the real question I have is because this issue has come up in some of the early debates and coverage of the mayoral campaign, the stop and frisk, is how will that change the city's behavior or their attitude towards this case or this issue if we get a new administration? You know, that's another thing that the coalition is trying to do, is really trying to make this issue front and center in the election, to try to get these candidates to take a position on the issue, because we think it's a very important issue for the city.
We can go to a whole nother show on that, Darius, considering who our group of people are. I mean, maybe, but I won't then mention names. I'm not optimistic.
No, I'm not. I'm not either, but
you're going to have to force every, as you did with the fire department, you're going to have to force every inch of the way.
But. Darius, thank you for being on Law and Disorder, and more broadly, I want to thank you for being such a good attorney and doing such a wonderful job on this case.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Welcome back ex-CIA analyst Ray McGovern to the show. President Obama delivered a major speech on May 23rd discussing his administration's use of drones, the possibility of perpetual war, and press freedom. The Obama administration has conducted hundreds of drone strikes in four countries, killing over 3,000 people, including four U.S. citizens. Critics point out that the Obama administration assassinates its suspects, and in doing so, avoids the legal complications of detention and trial. The London-based Bureau for Investigative Journalism estimates that about 830 civilians, including women and children, may have been killed by drone attacks in Pakistan alone, 138 in Yemen, and 57 in Somalia. To talk more about the Obama speech, U.S. drone warfare, the closing of Guantanamo, and the attacks on the press, we're joined by retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who recently wrote an excellent article entitled Doubting Obama's Resolve to Do Right. Ray, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Ray, we want to talk to you about defending the Constitution and the rule of law in this country. Obama gave a speech on May 23rd to the National Defense University, where he talked about Gitmo and he talked about droning and killing and talked about spying on and indicting reporters. The liberals seemed to be very pleased with this speech, and you dissected it, and we wanted to ask you about your take on this speech. At one point, you said that Obama was a wuss. What do you mean by that? Tell us what your take on. Let's take it apart and talk about where we're at right now.
Sure, Michael. First off, you're clearly not from the Bronx. The way to pronounce that is wuss. It's sort of a cross between a wimp and a pussycat, okay?
Got it.
And that's actually how it might be derived. I'm not sure.
Ray, but I read the article. Did you also call him a wimp in the article?
I did, yeah, because wuss was considered too strident to say twice.
Anyway, we're going to link to this article, Doubting Obama's Resolve to Do Right. It's by Ray McGovern. It's at consortiumnews.com. But we'll let you keep going. I just wanted people to know that there's an important article you wrote on that website.
Thank you.
Why wuss?
Well, at the time I said it, it was one of these Medea Benjamin Code Pink demonstrations in front of the White House, and Medea asked me to speak. Netanyahu was about 300 yards away. And Obama had just very loudly warned Netanyahu, no more settlements. And Netanyahu had given him the Bronx cheer and put thumb to nose and wagged the rest of his fingers and said, watch me. And Obama said, oh, okay. And that was one of my first clues that Obama really needed a spinal implant, okay, a backbone implant. And so I went to the doctors at George Washington University, and they're working on it, but they tell me it won't be ready for about 4 or 5 years, so it's up to us. All kidding aside, that was one of my first tips. Actually, the first tip came just after he was nominated, and he reversed himself on his previous determination, so he said, of holding those telecoms harmless for deliberately violating our Fourth Amendment rights. He said he would veto that, but he'd vote against it at least, not veto it, but vote against it. And then he thought better of it. He said, well, maybe it's okay, so we voted with it. So did Jay Rockefeller, so did other prominent, quote, liberals, end quote. And that was my first clue that he was taking the rest of us for granted, that whatever he needed to do, A, to get elected, and B, to stay in office, was just fine. There was no matter of conscience there, just a matter of practicality, a matter of expedience.
Let's talk about the speech. You could read that speech any way you want. The people who thought it was going to change a policy with respect to closing Guantanamo or changing the rules on droning people and executing them or going after reporters read it one way, and other people read it another way. What was your take on those three key points to that speech?
Well, it was a masterpiece of oratory, of rhetoric, but it was deceptive through and through. Those of us who have been following this, and unfortunately that doesn't include people who think they get news from the mainstream media, but those of us who have been watching this know that he lied through his teeth on many occasions. This business about, well, we ban torture. But what's going on in Guantanamo right now? Not only are people being force-fed torture by any definition, but they are being, well, let's put it this way, they are having their body cavities searched in such a way as to violate not only all Muslim sensitivities, but all human sensitivities in my book. And to prevent themselves from being subjected to that treatment, they are not even allowing themselves to see their lawyers. That is about as bad as it gets. You know, the next thing we'll hear is that TSA apprentices are going down to Guantanamo to be instructed on the proper techniques of cavity searches.
Yeah, really?
It's an abomination. And for Obama to avoid the word abomination or abomination is just really so crass. You know, it's words. You know, remember the My Fair Lady, my favorite musical. Words, words, words. I'm so sick of words. Don't talk of regret. Don't talk still yet. Show me. And he doesn't show. He has the power, as we all know, to release 86 prisoners in the next hour. Why does he have that power? Because Carl Levin expended some political capital in fighting for a waiver of the restrictions that Congress has imposed, a waiver that will allow Obama to release these people by simply citing this national security waiver in the legislation. So for Obama to get up and say, what kind of a country are we? Oh, do we want to leave this kind of thing to our children? When he can release 86 people at the snap of his finger, you know, is not only disingenuous, it's not worthy.
When I heard that line, of course, as you know, I represent Guantanamo people, I thought the biggest lie in the speech, and that's what it was, it says, I have tried to close Guantanamo. And then you go through what you just mentioned, not exercising the waivers, and there's a half a dozen other ways in which he has actually sabotaged the closing of Guantanamo. Straight lie.
Yeah, which leads to, you know, to the question of why would he do all these things? Why would he be so afraid, for example, to take the drones away from the CIA? Well, I've come to the conclusion that he's afraid. Number one, he's afraid of what happened to Martin Luther King Jr. And I know from a good friend who was there when it happened that at a small dinner with progressive supporters, after these progressive supporters were banging on Obama before the election, why don't you do the things we thought you stood for? Obama turned sharply and said, don't you remember what happened to Martin Luther King Jr.? That's a quote. And that's a very revealing quote. The other thing is, I've always been kind of shocked that when he came into office, not only did he not prosecute the torturers, or the kidnappers, the people with the black prisons, or even the people who violated our Fourth Amendment rights, he left them all in place. And, you know, I suspected at the time, and now I'm pretty convinced, the President of the United States is afraid of the CIA. That's why he got John Brennan in place. He thinks John Brennan owes more personal loyalty to him than all those other thugs out there that did the torture and so forth. That's a questionable thing, but if Obama thinks that, that's why he fought so hard, so that Brennan would be in place. Now, does he have any reason to fear the CIA? Well, he sure as heck does. For those of your listeners who have not read James Douglas's quote, JFK and the Unspeakable, end quote. You need to read that because it's coming up on 50 years. The mystery has not been solved in mainstream press. After reading James Douglas, who took advantage of all the previous studies, plus the more recent information released by Congress, I am convinced that John Kennedy was assassinated largely by Alan Dulles, whom he cashiered as head of the CIA after the Bay of Pigs, and a coterie of Joint Chiefs of Staff, FBI, even some Secret Service folks who thought that JFK was being soft on communism by back-channel communications with Khrushchev, that he was playing games with Fidel Castro, playing games. Yeah, he had some envoys there talking to Castro about what they might do to repair the relationship. And worst of all, he was giving Southeast Asia to the communists. Now, is there evidence for this? There sure as heck is. John Kennedy signed two executive orders just a month or so before he was killed. One of them said, we're pulling out 1,000 troops out of South Vietnam by the end of the year being 1963. The other said, we're going to pull out the bulk of the rest of the troops by the end of 1965. We're finished in Vietnam. That's a matter of record. Was that a unanimous decision? No, well, if you say the president that makes a one-person decision, it was unanimous. Everybody else thought he was crazy, especially the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So you need to read that book, and then you need to reflect on Obama. If he is sort of a wuss or a wimp or a person who just has no real principles, but rather is a politician through and through, and he's got two small kids, and, you know, he doesn't want to get killed. I have to say that I never thought I would hear myself saying this, but it is the only logical explanation for why he is so afraid, unless you say the man is a through-and-through charlatan, that he actually is acting on behalf of these powers of darkness. I don't believe the latter. I think he's just afraid. And he shouldn't have run for president if he was going to be this much of a wuss.
Ray McGovern, I agree with you.
I read JFK and the Unspeakable by James Douglas. My wife read it. A number of my friends read it. The back of the book has blurbs from the most authoritative people who've studied the Kennedy assassination. And they all agree, and I agree with you, that Kennedy was most likely killed by top echelons of the CIA and people in the military, and killed for the reasons that you state, that he was reversing America's policy towards Cuba, towards Vietnam, and reaching out to the Soviet Union because he didn't want to see a Third World War. It almost came about after the Bay of Pigs, and he didn't want to see that, and he was trying to do something about it. It's overwhelmingly documented. You refer to that book, JFK and the Unspeakable, as a masterful book. That is likely the reason that you see Obama wavering like he does, where he indicts his own administration, and then he gives a speech that supports policies that will continue what they've been doing.
You know, the only thing I'm not sure about, I mean, I understand the Kennedy stuff. I just think Obama is an accommodator, and he's an accommodator to the Democrats. He's an accommodator to the national security establishment. Sure, he may have a fear of what happened to JFK and King, but he's shown that from the very beginning. Good rhetoric, no action. We're going to see it again, and we're seeing it again and again. It's hard to say. We don't know what's going on in his mind, Ray, but it could certainly be as much the fact that the guy is just an incredible accommodator. He's in the ilk of other presidents we've had. I mean, Clinton was like that. He eventually sold us out on a million issues. Democrat, Republican, they all do it.
Yeah, I don't see the two thoughts as being contradictory. Was there anything in Obama's speech that one could interpret he's winding down these wars, or just the opposite? Where do you think things are going?
The war's got to end. This one's going to end. There was one part in the speech where he says, you know, it's just not constitutional. It's just not within the rule of law to assassinate people, including American citizens.
Ray, if our listeners want to get in touch with you or get to your website, can you give us that information and how they can reach out to more articles by you?
Sure. My website is raymcgovern.com, but I publish first on Bob Perry's consortiumnews.com. It's a unheralded but one of the best websites out there.
I'm on it. We'll link to it. I also want to give our program a plug, lawanddisorder.org. We had interviewed James Douglas on JFK and the Unspeakable. And for our listeners, if they want to get that interview, they can just go to lawanddisorder.org and type in James Douglas, and that interview will come up.
Really appreciate the piece, because there's such a wave of information going the wrong way on Obama's speech. Although I was with some friends who just walked out. They just couldn't stand them hearing it again. I mean, I remember listening to the May 21st speech, 2009, from he was draped in the Constitution. This one, at least, he was draped in a war college. But just the same speeches again and again. I mean, the 3 points here: endless war, drones, and Guantanamo. I mean, we still have drones, we still have Guantanamo, and we're going to have endless war as long as we're dropping drones and continue dominating the Middle East.
Yeah, and 8 American flags behind you should not disguise the fact of what you're doing. A word about James Douglas. Some people say, well, he must have an axe to grind. Well, the fellow's a Catholic worker, okay? He tends to the poor in Birmingham, Alabama, where he set up a Catholic worker house, and he lives on a railroad track. And if you talk to him for any length, he's got to say, well, I'll call you back, because he lives right on the railroad track, okay? So Douglas is the real deal. Read that book, and I think you'll get some hints as to why Obama is so scared.
Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder, and we look forward to talking to you again. Thank you, Ray.
Okay, bye now.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.